This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Good evening. Welcome to the Late Late Show on this Monday Eve. Tonight we are talking about pastoral roles in schools. Mainly, does the reward outweigh the misery? So if you are a member of pastoral staff or you're interested in taking a leap into pastoral roles and you want to know the real truth about what the job is like, this is definitely the show for you.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
So, good evening again. I think I might have been having minor mic issues. If you didn't hear or you've just joined, we are discussing pastoral roles in schools tonight. So, oh boy, I don't even know where to start. So this is a topic that's very close to my heart, very close to my career, very close to every waking moment of my life for much of the past decade. And when I first became a head of year many years ago, I feel like the people around me tried in their own way to be honest. They tried to tell me what they thought would help me, but they didn't. And I feel like there's a lot of fear or reluctance to share the honest truth about what pastoral roles in schools actually entail. So rather than taking my usual approach of here's a problem in education, why don't we talk about this? Or here's something interesting that's going on. Here's something that matters. Why don't we talk about this and maybe give a bit of time over to have an honest, safe space rant or, you know, honest discussion. And then try to end it on a positive note or come up with some solutions or some top tips to make it easier. Rather than taking that approach tonight, I think we just need to talk about the truth, about what actually goes on when you are a head of year in a school or when you are in a pastoral role, a year lead, pastoral support, behavior support, whatever they may call be called in a particular place. I feel like there just needs to be a little bit of honesty. So anyone who's interested in making the jump or needs someone to commiserate with can find that here. And then we can refer to this, and you can refer to this, dear listeners, whenever someone in your life says, oh, there's a head of year position opening up at my school. And you can say, well, actually, don't. So part of this attitude is because it is such a major part of my life for so long. But also, I am having a week, and I apologize in advance if one of my lungs comes up through my mouth and you can hear it through your headphones. I deeply apologize. I'll try my best to mute my mic when I have to hack one of them up. So all of this is contributing to my current attitude. Now, I really am excited to have this honest conversation with my guest tonight. Jordan is a dear friend of mine. She's been a colleague for many years. We've got a couple decades of pastoral head of year-ness between us. So that makes us sound really old, but I like to think we're actually not. And Jordan is also, I would say probably more honest and direct than I am, but in a, again, I would like to say probably a nicer way. I don't know if she'd agree with me. Jordan, do you agree with me?
Sorry. Hi, Ray. honest, very upfront sometimes to my own, you know, demise. I would say that I'm very direct, but I believe that sometimes that's the best way. At least you know where you stand with me. I'm not rude with it, but I think you just know where you stand. And I'm just very clear.
Yeah, and that's what we need. That's exactly what we need, because we worked together at the same school in London for a number of years, and I feel that you did you join that school as pastoral staff?
No, okay. I didn't. So I started in the SEN department.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I was really, really keen to work directly with children. So working in a classroom, I thought, okay. But then I thought, actually, I really want to be able to help and support a different group of children. So I started first in the SEN department, not directly working in the classroom, but helping to write what we now know as EHCP's statements back then. And just organizing and ensuring that the children had their correct support in class and things like that. So it was really interesting. And then the opportunity came up. If I'm honest, I did sit down and think, that was going to be my job. That was my dream job to be
a year. We say that with like slight resentment. We can't even say the word opportunity seriously, but carry on.
Yeah, I thought, yeah, this is me. This is a bit of me. And then I went for the job, got the job, and we are years in now.
Yeah.
My oldest year group are 22 years old.
Oh, I didn't calculate that.
Yeah, they're 22 years old. 23 this year, to be exact.
Oh, babies have grown. Yeah, it's been crazy. A while. Yeah.
It's crazy.
I think, anyway, yeah, it's, well, mine was weird because when I went from being a teacher to a teaching head of year, that was the year you moved to year seven, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was.
So, but that was also the year that I had that year. I took on year 11 for that one year before I went back down to year eight. So it was that strange, strange transition.
Strange
transition. Yes. So yeah, we've got a wild range of experience, I think, between us. And again, another apology. I have two cats who are currently fighting behind me. So any background noise you can hear is either my cats or one of my lungs trying to make an appearance. So, what inspired you? Let's start with some positives. Let's do what we can. What inspired you? You said you wanted to work with a particular group of people and you really wanted to work directly with children. So what yes. went through your mind? What conversations did you have when that position came up within the school to move into the head of year role?
So I obviously spoke to my friends first, and they were actually really supportive. Now I look back thinking, were they my friends? Because they were all like, go for it. You'll be great. I think one of the things was I have always been very, very passionate about supporting young people. And I always say, if I have one kid that leaves and they are a success, then I've mm-hmm. done a good job. Because you can't reach them all. You can't reach them all. But I just always feel that if there's one that leaves and, you know, look back and they think, oh, my goodness, you helped me do this. You helped me get through. And that for me was, I felt really strongly about that because I am, you know, to my own, I'm very, very much an advocate for children. And I think you have to be in this role because that is the role or part of the role. But it's really important that the children feel that they can relate to you. And I felt that I was very relatable. I haven't come from a typical family. I've had to make my way through life. And I think it's important that children see other people that haven't necessarily had a 2-point, you know, for have mum, dad, brother, sister, everybody living at home and their life is all perfect and smooth. Because it wasn't like that for me. And I've had to work hard to get to where I am. But I look back and I'm really, really proud of it. And I encourage the students to look at what they can achieve, what they can gain for themselves in life. So it was mainly just me within myself thinking, what change, what difference can I make to another child's life? How can I be supportive? How can I get a kid into school every day, get them to engage in lessons, get them to know that there's somebody there who cares. So with the encouragement of my friends and, you know, members of my family, because they were really go for it, I said, okay, you can do this. And I went for it and got the job. And it's all history. I'm still there.
Still there. Yeah.
Still there, I have... fighting the good fight.
So I feel like I need to explain. Right. So since I left your school, my former school, in the summer because we moved to the Midlands, so I left London, I've been back twice to visit. Now, I'm acutely aware that this is deeply uncool. And I feel like I have felt both times, and this is not your fault, but I felt both times, obviously, like the year 11 loser who, you know, leaves school and then just is hanging around outside the school gate or in the car park or something, like waiting for their younger friends to come out and say hi. But I have absolutely no shame about it because you everyone in that school really is so wonderful and so lovely. And we were talking about, I don't think you were in the room when we were talking about this. But one of the other heads of year was like, you know, Ray, you were such a good person. If I left these people, I'd be done.
But
you guys are so, it's a special kind of place where you do have those members of staff that really do genuinely care and have formed, like we had, and I'm assuming you guys still have, it looks like you do, the team. And there's that sense of team where everybody actually supports each other. And it is not like that everywhere. And you're all obviously my friends and I want to see you. And the easiest way of doing that is by like popping in on a Friday afternoon when we have different half term breaks. So,
definitely.
So I have no shame, but I've definitely seen even the two times I've been back to visit. It just sounds like such a loser saying that, but the two times I've been back, it's, I mean, you so clearly care about these kids and there is such that sense of team that is still apparent. Yeah. And I don't think any of us would have survived how we did or as long as we did or as long as you have without that sense of, without having each other's backs and making that really clear to each other constantly. I think it's an impossible job to do if you don't have a solid team that you're working with.
Absolutely. You know, the people that I work with in my close team, it's, you know, you can have a day where you walk in and you could be having the worst morning ever, but then another head of year may come into my office or somebody else on the pastoral team. And then it's, you know, they're making you smile. They get you through the day. Yeah. It's just amazing. I mean, I would agree. Definitely. I work with some fantastic people. And you are sorely missed because obviously
I know
addition. it's a difficult job, but I think when you have a supportive team, it makes such a difference.
It does, and especially because I remember in my was it my first or second year as head of year, I think it was my first year. I think that's when I had the first kind of dip. That was a different year. So there are a few really difficult things that happened in my first year of head of year, but I think maybe it was the second year. February of my second year. Sorry, I'll get to the point eventually. And I remember sitting in my bedroom and it was like, I was in a weird place, I think socially with things outside of work. And I remember sitting in my bedroom and thinking, this is what loneliness feels like. And it was nothing to do with you guys. It was everything to do with the fact that I hadn't quite accepted the fact that my day-to-day life had changed, because I'd gone from being a full-time teacher, English teacher in a secondary school, who was in and out of the English office. I mean, I had a weird classroom miles away from everything, but when I could be, I was in the English office, and they were my team and they were my friend. I mean, they still are my friends, but they were my team on the day-to-day, like in and out. We had each other's backs. And then suddenly, and no one talked to me about this part, suddenly I was taken out of that and put in this strange little office. And I felt really isolated from what I thought was my team. And it was during that weird transition. Those first 2 years were bizarre, man. There was some stuff going on. And I hadn't really settled into that team. And I just felt really side of the one that I was used to. And I, as I said, no one had, like, that hadn't occurred to me in my mind that I was going to feel isolated or distant. And it was no one's fault. It wasn't anyone's behavior that caused it. It was just my position changed. Within the school had changed. Yeah. And that could be really isolating. Absolutely. And I was sat in my bedroom like, this is loneliness. And then I downloaded Tinder. But I also got much more, like, I tried to get much more stuck into the pastoral team and really kind of embed myself there without losing touch with everybody else. But I think that's one of the shocks to the system when you go from a particular role in a school. Yeah. Whether it's SEN like you were, whether it's like an English teacher like I was, and then moving, it's still the same kids. It's the same people. In a different way and different amounts. And that can be like surprisingly shocking and difficult to manage. So I think any kind of side by step in the same institution can be a lot rougher. That's my cat. A lot rougher than people expect it to be.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't occur to me anyway. Maybe I was just young and stupid, but it was really difficult.
No, over the years, we've had a few changes, within the pastoral department. And it was a change, you coming in. It was a change. We've had a few changes. But I think that one of the things is definitely just learning about each other and learning about, I think it's really important that you get to know each other, even on a personal note. You know, like, I know you like cats. You know, you like dogs is a new thing. But I think getting to know each other on a personal level really allows you to sort of bond, because you bond over the moments with these kids. And then if you have that relationship where you're actually friends, it makes the hard times easier. It makes the hard times easier, definitely.
Yeah, because it's such a different, and now we're kind of getting into what is, you know, what is the job and what does that entail? Because there's so much. I have a sheet in front of me full of notes, and just at the top it says trials, tribulations, and trauma.
Oh yes.
And I feel like that's pretty much it in a nice little alliterative list.
Put it this way.
How would you read? Yeah.
What you read online? If you googled the job. It's not fully, mm-hmm. it's not fully that.
No, it's not. 100% agreed. No, it is. I have heard things I wish I could unhear. I have seen so many things that haunt my nightmares that I wish I could unsee. Things that should not exist. Yes. That let alone be seen by another human being. I have heard and seen so many things. You are, like, I also have on my note sheet, what is the job of a head of year or pastoral leader or behavior support or whatever, you know, anyone in pastoral. And it's just, it's that thing, you know, like the cartoons of the teachers where they're carrying all these books or blocks or bags or whatever the particular cartoon is. And one says, therapist, and one says social worker, counselor. And one says
parents.
You know, all these things, and then it's that times a thousand, because it is actually your job to pick all of these things up. And our school, one of the things I loved about our school, your current school, is, and I love it and I hate it, they trained all of us. Like, we were all really highly trained in safeguarding. So it was the head, when I was there, it was we were the ones going to the child protection conferences. We were the ones going to the child in need meetings. Like, we were having these meetings and going to these events and hearing these things. And I remember walking out of one of them with one of my students and just having to call somebody and be like, for the first time in like 3 years, I want to walk into the corner shop and buy a pack of cigarettes. Yeah. Like, that's how I feel right now. Yeah. It's ridiculous. It's really, really hard.
It's hard.
And I think even if your school, it takes a different tack. Like, I've worked in a school where the heads of year did not have that safeguarding training up to the same level. And the safeguarding team was very, I think, overly protective yeah. of what they did. And so that we almost felt like we were not doing enough, and we weren't aware yeah. of enough, and we weren't involved enough. But still,
it's different.
Even yeah. then, yeah. even then, we were hearing things and seeing yeah. things and getting hearing disclosures more than I ever did as a yeah. as a classroom teacher. And it's and it, everybody talks about this aspect of it, but I don't think they really understand. Are honest about how yeah, yeah, yeah. and how yeah. much that can affect mm. people. Mm. Especially when you have to then switch off and like go yell yeah. at 12-year-olds about apostrophes yeah. or in your case, like go home to your children.
Yeah, it's really, really hard. I think over the years, because initially when I first started the job, I would carry it all home. I would mm-hmm. literally go to a meeting and then come home and I would sit in the car. And there were times where I would cry on my way home yeah. because some of the things that these children go through, it's things that you watch in movies.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't believe it's real life. And the reality is it is real life for some of these kids. Mm-hmm. It absolutely is. And you have to be able to build yourself up. I mean, I'm at a point now where it's not that I disassociate myself from it, but I have to put my hat on and I just think, what can I do to help this kid? How yeah. can I be the most supportive for this child on an everyday basis? Because this child has to come into school every day, no matter yeah. what's going on in their house. And this is where I see where the head of year role is so important, because I think it's great that you can get a kid into a classroom. And I think it's great that you may wish that they're going to get these eights and nines. But the reality yeah. is, if a child isn't okay at home, they're never going to be able to be yeah. the best academically. And that is a reality.
Yeah.
That is a reality. And it's really hard, but I think you have to be able to be that strong person for the child. You have to be able to just stand strong every day and let that child know that you are there, that you have their back, yeah. you're there, you're a listening ear, you're a shoulder to cry on. You know, that you stand for them, you support them, you care about them. You know, they have to know that yeah. you care. And it is a really, really hard job, because it yeah. is tiring. You know, I used to come home, and my biggest son now is 15, and I would come home on some days and barely want to have a conversation, because mm-hmm. I have talked so much at work, and then mm-hmm. I have to come home and talk to my own kids. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, please give it a rest. Mm-hmm. You don't really want to.
Yeah.
You don't really want to hear about it. And worse, if they're in trouble at school, then you're having to come up and deal with your own kid. It's like, yeah. oh my gosh, please. Yeah. So yeah. It's really, really difficult. But I think over the years, I've grown in the role.
Yeah.
And I've been able to manage. And don't get me wrong, I absolutely still sometimes sit back and think, wow. But I think what I've done is I've learned to come home and I will walk the dog, or, you know, I will just take a moment. Sometimes I just listen to music in the car on the way home, or watch yeah. crap TV, you know, just anything to just take my mind off of it. You know, it's something that you have to take that time, because it yeah. will suck you dry carrying, because you're carrying the load. You carry the yep. load, you carry all this information for all these children. And it's a lot. It's a lot, right?
It is a lot. And it's something that you can't really prepare for. I mean, I think if you're a certain kind of person, or you've, you know, been subjected to certain life experiences, you're going to have a better sense of where you stand with this than some other people. But it is one of those things you can't actually appreciate it until you're in it, or unless you've, you know, done a similar kind of job where you're dealing yeah. with that sort of information before. Yeah. And it really does take a certain kind of person to stick that out for any length of time.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Otherwise, you're going to, yeah.
You're lost. You can yeah. lose yourself too, because it's almost like you take in all this information and it just weighs you down. Yeah. And then you wake up one day and you just think, I can't do this anymore. It's too much. Yeah. It's just, it can be really, really draining, really emotionally mm-hmm. draining. But you just have to just remind yourself that, you know, the reason why you're doing it, why are you doing this? What difference yeah. you were going to make to that child's life? just being there in the morning and saying, are you okay?
Yeah. You have to focus on the positive that you are, yeah, the positive impacts you're having, which some days doesn't feel like many.
Because that's another
aspect of it. When you're not at these meetings, you know, talking to actual social workers and actual parents about their children, you are constantly fighting fires within the school and dealing with absurd behavior situations. And because they're kids, they're doing the same stupid stuff over and over again and don't listen.
Take the socks off. No socks and tights, mm-hmm. You know, the same conversations, you know, be safe online. Stop joining these WhatsApp groups. Something happened on the weekend, you're coming in with the evidence. Told you not to be in these WhatsApp groups. You know, it's the same thing. You stand up there, you do an assembly, you talk to them about all these dangers, all these things, and they still go and do the same thing. And you just have to keep reminding yourself, they're just kids.
And it's one thing when, you know, you repeat yourself ad nauseum and they don't learn the difference between a simile and a metaphor and bomb and assessment. Like that is not the end of the world. But when the mistakes that they keep repeating are literally endangering, in some cases, their lives.
Dangerous.
And you have to sit there and be encouraging, unconditional positive regard, and you just want to shake them. Why do I care more about your life than you do?
Exactly. That is really, really difficult. When you get a child that is so just not getting it, you know, like, and you just keep going out there. I mean, it's like currently one of the major issues that schools have is vaping.
Yeah.
They continue and continue and continue all the time. No matter how many times you tell them, you don't know what this is going to do to your lungs. You don't know what this is going to do to your body. You're underage. You shouldn't be doing this. You're going to be suspended. And they will keep going and keep going and keep going. And, you know, this is the sort of thing that I find really difficult because, for instance, vaping, some of these kids are actually addicted, Ray. They are addicted. But what do I do about that? What can you?
Are you a doctor?
Exactly.
What are you a parent?
What do I do?
What are you supposed to do? All I feel like, and this is another. Oh man, we're gonna get into this after the break in a second. But that idea of what am I supposed to do in this situation? You feel like you're constantly in the middle of absolutely everyone demands, requests, non-negotiables, but you're so limited by all of these things and more. Yeah. And because you're the first point of contact, because you're the first person that parents email or ring, because you're the behavior leader of that year group, you're the first person they call. And it's like, what am I supposed to do with a 13-year-old that's addicted to vapes?
Exactly.
Am I supposed to throw them in detention? Am I supposed to get them? Because that's really going to help. Do you know what I mean? You're trying to focus on the individual while keeping an eye on the bigger picture, but you are just a cog in this machine as a middle leader. Yeah. You have no actual authority, no actual decision-making power. Some schools are incredibly micromanaging. I've worked in one where I felt like a trained monkey could do what I was doing on a daily basis. And you're getting it from all sides. And I need to take a break to breathe. So we will be back right after this.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This week in the news, is World Book Day a burden on parents? Has the tide turned against hyper-discipline in schools? Is Scotland going to be excluding more students? Should we be talking up the benefits of going to school at a school that is turning the clock back on mobile phones. World Book Day on March the 7th has become a fixture in the school calendar, where pupils are encouraged to come to school dressed as their favourite characters, or bring books to donate or tell their friends about. This celebration of reading, though, has become a little controversial, as reported in the BBC and The Guardian. Parents have complained of increasing pressure to buy commercialised costumes or spend time and money elaborately creating their own. Some of the pressure has a class element, with some parents sending their children to school dressed as characters from Harry Potter, while others might be the Artful Dodger. Head teacher Fran Davis from Michigan Primary School in Mountain Ash has said she wants the day to be fun without being a financial burden. Therefore, she suggests that pupils can come in their pajamas, suggesting their favourite bedtime book, or simply in school uniform, as they might be pupils at Hogwarts or even Greyfriars. If you wish to hear teachers' views on World Book Day, listen to last week's Late Show with Lucy Neuberger on Teachers Talk Radio. One of the most significant developments in education in the last few decades has been the trend towards positive discipline, or military-style discipline, in schools. And this provides the context for the next two stories this week. The first story appeared on the BBC and was covered by the Guardian newspaper. And it's about the Michaela School, led by the controversial head teacher, sometimes described as Britain's strictest head teacher, Catherine Burgle Singh, who has been in the news for the school's policy towards Muslim prayers. Half of the pupils of the school are Muslim students. Two students have given interviews where they describe a toxic atmosphere of the school and an atmosphere of fear and being stripped of their identity. If you wish to learn more of this story, you can find Tom Rogers' interview with Catherine Burgle Singh on this topic on Teachers Talk Radio. The increasing prevalence of tiger-style teaching, strict discipline methods, zero tolerance, and first-time, every-time expectations of students across British schools was highlighted when a parent at Boston Spa Academy complained her autistic son found school intolerable, as over a period of only a few days, he acquired 56 negative comments and several days in isolation. Boston Spa Academy schools have appeared frequently in Education Uncovered and other news outlets for their strict approach involving lining up for inspections and an expectation that rules will be obeyed instantly and at all times. Not for the first time, teachers' unions have described these policies as inhumane. This week, Scotland's Education Secretary, Jenny Gilruth, announced that there would be a review of Scottish Government's policy on exclusions. The number of exclusions from schools has dropped considerably in recent years, as a determined policy of avoiding school exclusion was adopted following research of a link between excluded students and later involvement in crime. However, with one-third of teachers in Scotland reporting in a survey of the EIS Union that they had suffered assault or physical violence in the previous year, pressure to review the non-exclusion policy has resulted in a reconsideration. School attendance is once again in the news. A survey revealed that nearly a third, 32% of teachers and school leaders have experienced pupils being absent this academic year because of a parental dispute with the school. The survey by Teacher Tap asked 8,411 teachers and leaders in state schools in England in January what reasons they had been given for pupils missing school this academic year, other than illness. More than half, 51%, said pupils had been kept home because they were tired after an event the night before. Nearly 9 out of 10, 87%, said wanting to take a holiday during term time was the reason, while more than 3 in 4, 76%, pointed to family events. John Camp, president of the Association of School and College Leaders, warned in a speech to the union's annual conference that the unwritten social contract between families and schools is fracturing, and he called for a change of tone in the national conversation about education to ensure that people talk up schools and colleges. And finally, another story from the BBC where Milldown Academy in Blandford Forum head teacher Mr. Law has adopted the policy of providing brick phones, old-fashioned simple mobile phones for students. Parents can hire or borrow them as an alternative to smartphones, which are increasingly distracting in the school. You can find more discussion of these and other stories on Teachers Talk Radio or reviewed each Sunday on Teachers Talk Radio panel, which you can find the links to on YouTube or the Teachers Talk Radio site. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio news with John Gibbs.
So we have a text from Paul who says, "Hi, I've been in primary for 16 years. Do you have many primary pupils? So Jordan, this will be good for you as head of year 7. Do you have many primary pupils who carry their problems through to you in high school? Which ones have you found have lasted longest for those children?" So I have some thoughts here. Obviously, you will have more thoughts and be better placed to answer this. But when we're talking about issues students face when they're in primary school carrying through, I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is just is a constant issue that we face in secondary is this information communication, information sharing gap. There are so many things that seem to just disappear into the ether or fall through the gaps. Schools should pass on X, Y, and Z, should inform us of all of these important things. And somehow magically they don't. These kids show up. We don't know what we should know. Yeah, sometimes literally with nothing. And we're expected to meet their needs when we don't know what they are, support them when we don't know how. And it just massive problems. And as if the year 7 transition isn't stressful enough, so many problems are exacerbated in that situation anyway. And if we could just seamlessly pick up where primary schools leave off, then everything would be so much better. But in practice, it doesn't work that way.
No, not at all. You know, it's really difficult when a primary school doesn't pass on the information. I mean, for instance, children will turn up and they have a social worker because there's an incident with a child, a previous incident involving a family incident, for instance. And this child will be in the school for weeks. And then all of a sudden, I receive an email saying, "Oh, by the way, we've got a meeting next week." I don't even know what this meeting's for. I have not been informed of anything. This poor child has been experiencing all sorts in their family life and have joined me. And I have no idea until this. I get this random email from a social worker saying, "Oh, there's a meeting next week." And then I have to email back and then say, "Sorry, can I just ask what this meeting is about? What, you know, what is it that this child has experienced? Because I have no idea." You know, it's really difficult. You know, we can also look at the fact when schools, a child, for instance, is possibly ADHD or ASD or needs to be seen by an EP because, you know, they have some sort of need and the primary school has not done it. They then come to us, and the minute I've met this child, I'm like, "Oh my goodness, I can see that this child has this child's autistic. This child's autistic. How could nobody? How was this missed? How was this just let go?" And then they've come to me, and then we still need weeks upon weeks of evidence before months before we can even put in an EP for an EP assessment. You know, but you've had them for 6 years. And not done it. And then they come to a school of over 1,000 children and then, you know, they fall to the bottom of the pile again. And it's really, really sad when that happens. It's really difficult when that happens because I feel that we're doing a disservice to the children. I feel like, you know, in some ways that I get these parents calling me, "Oh, please, my, you know, I was on at the primary school." And I have to explain to this poor parent that I can't just put in a referral for you. I don't know your child, you know, and it takes, you know, with year 7, even then it still takes, you need to give them at least a term to settle in. So, you know, it takes so long for the process. And actually if primary schools just did it in primary school and then they follow through with it, then they come in and I know exactly what support that they would need. And then it just allows the child to come to us and it just allows it to be more of a seamless process. And every, you know, the child feels better, the support is put in place, the parent feels better. That alleviates a lot of the parent's stress too. you know, yeah. But sometimes it just doesn't happen. You know, one of the things I ask is that all the files are sent down, because I actually try and read all of their files.
Yeah, so you do. I know you do.
Yeah. Just so I can get an idea of the child. And that's every file. That if that's a CP file, the regular file, the SEN file, I read all of them just so I can get an idea and see, you know, if this child has any difficulties, what I can do. But if that file doesn't turn up until Christmas, January, then what am I doing here?
And see that it's that kind of minor stuff, because thinking about EHCPs and seeing EPs and all the big paperwork, I working in education, I understand the time pressure, the staffing pressure, the need to prioritize the younger students rather than the ones that are going to age out of the school in two terms. Yeah. Like I'm not justifying it. I'm saying the position that we are placed in because of this government and this system, I understand it. So I understand why some children do not get the diagnoses that they should have before they come to us in second year. I understand why that happens sometimes. What I don't understand, and because Paul's asked a follow up here, what is the process? Like, what is it? What can primary schools do better? Do you know what primary schools can do? Because there's no excuse not to send the file over to second year. Send the paperwork. If you can't do anything else, if you can't get something else done, send us the files.
Send them on over. Yep, definitely.
Like that to me is just the most frustrating. It's one of those like admin things that should just happen. Yeah. There's no excuse for it not. And then without saying, like, of course it's not all primary schools. Of course it's not all teachers. Of course it's not all everybody.
No.
But there, it happens so much.
So much. Difficult. Absolutely. Yeah. It makes it difficult, because then I receive a phone call from a parent saying, oh, didn't the primary school tell you? No.
No.
No, they didn't.
They didn't tell us, Jack.
It would just make the process so much easier if they just provided the information. I mean, you know, I actually speak to the primary schools also. I actually try and have phone calls with the primary schools just so I can get the information that I need on each child. Because I like to, before they come in, I like to have an idea of, because I have to put them into form. So I like to have an idea of who would work well in a form.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of doing small group work, you know, in terms of behavior or, you know, if there's any kids that I can put together in a group, then I like to, who would need mentoring, who would need, you know, some other kind of support, who can I support on a one-on-one basis. So I like to have that information before, because I just, transition to secondary school is such a big thing, like you said. It's so hard and it's so scary, and it's such a change from primary school to secondary school, that I think one of the things is parents aren't, if you haven't had a child that's gone to secondary school before, it is frightening. There's no longer the teacher in the playground standing there where you can just, you know, go and ask a question. There's it's almost like they feel like we take their children in, and then there's a wall that's built up, and they you know, like they can't step past that wall. It's
because they're not used to the change. I'm not going to say lack of change in communication and the amount of information they're given, because the size of the school, the nature of moving from subject to subject, class to class, to teacher. I can imagine. And I'm saying this because I really need to temper my frustration with some parents. I can imagine that is a very frustrating experience for them as well. And if they're not used to it, as you said, like if this is their eldest child or their only child going through that change for the first time, it must feel like there's a bit of a block there. And I can imagine that it might feel like, you know, the school you sent your child to is just not doing what they should do. It's like, well, actually they are. It's a secondary school. Welcome to the next stage of life.
Exactly.
But yeah, it is very, very different. And just going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, it is the system. It's this, the you move these kids from what could be a large, small, we don't know, a primary school up into a big secondary. Many of them don't cope. Many of them struggle. And schools, primary schools may have had difficulties with those students. Now we are having difficulties with how those students are coping or trying to support them to cope better. And you want to do all of these things. You want to support them. You want to put X, Y, and Z in place. You want to do all these things, but we just don't have the resources.
Yeah.
We don't have the ability to do that. And we can't change the entire building layout or staffing or timetable. Do you know what I mean? The number, I commented something on Twitter, X, whatever, today, just because I was thinking about the show, and it was just, I long ago lost track as a head of year, the amount of times I've had to say to parents, I hear you, yeah. I hear you, I understand, but it is physically, like, it is against the laws of physics type, impossible for us to provide what you are asking for.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So take this email that you've written me, change a couple of the details, and send it to your MP.
Exactly.
What can I physically do?
Yeah.
And that is such a typical experience when you are the first person. The first point of call, the first person they contact, the first person they complain to, the first person everything. Yeah. And it as a head of year, and it gets, I feel like there are better people than me that can deal with that better. Like water off a duck's back. Just
make the change. Yeah. People that can make the change.
I'm not so great at getting 15 vitriolic emails a day about what amounts to, for in my perspective, foolishness, and not letting that bother me. It's so hard.
That is the worst. I mean, opening your emails and just seeing absolute, sometimes just requests that are, you are not serious. You really expect me to do that kind of responses to.
Yeah.
It's really difficult. It's really difficult, and then you get some where the parents are just crying for help.
Yeah. And it's really sad because, again, you want to do so many things, and in an ideal world, you maybe could.
But it just doesn't work like that. It doesn't. We don't have an on-site CAMS worker.
No.
We don't have an on-site EP. We don't, it's not something where I can just click my magic fingers and, I'm going to get your child to the top of the CAMS list. The waiting list is like 2-3 years. That is one of the hardest parts of the job where, you look at a child and you know what they need. You know they need that support. But all you can do is fill in a form, and then they wait and wait.
And then the parents call up, understandably chasing it up, and all you can do is say, "Well, I've done this, and this." Sorry, I don't like it. It's just the most helpless feeling when, because you said earlier that your job is to be the advocate for these children, and we all get into this job because we want to help these kids. We want to make their lives better. And I went into pastoral really believing that. And I still do believe that. I'm still teaching, but I really thought that was a better way to do it. And I've come out of it because I'm not ahead of you right now. I stepped the heck away from that. And I came out of it just feeling so frustrated and so impotent and so angry at the system.
The system.
And all that, when you're in the system, you're forest for the trees, right? And you start getting angry at the trees when they're angry at you when it's really the forest. That's the problem. It's just relentless.
It's hard. Yeah, it is.
It's so hard.
It's really, really hard.
I have another question from Paul. So you might know the answer to this. So Paul's asking about the school files again. So like, is it law that primary schools have to send it to secondary schools? Is it just like the done thing? Is it expected? Is there some sort of like, do not all primary schools do it because they feel like they shouldn't, or they feel like they don't have to?
No. Oh, so As far as I'm aware, there isn't a law what says it has to be sent by, say, August the 31st. You know, it's there's not a law that says that, but it would be good practice. And I think sometimes the problem is it depends. So there are some schools that are really good and they will just send a bulk. And then you may get a random one months later where they've realized. And to be fair, sometimes it's not just the primary school's fault, because sometimes a child tells them that they're going to one school and then they change and then go to our school. And then their file has gone to that other school and then they haven't just sent it on. So, you know, there are different reasons, but as far as I'm aware, there's not a law as such, but it would just be good practice to just send it. If you know where the child is going, send them on. It clears out your area for you to move your files up, you know, just send them on, because then it just gives me a chance to just go through and make sure that I'm not missing anything. So, you know, it's just one of those things, really. I don't think there's a law around it.
Yeah. So it's really just something that should be happening. And I feel like that's fairly obvious. And I feel like if you're listening and you're a primary teacher, you work in a primary school and you're thinking, well, of course we always do. Well, congratulations. Good job. Thank you. Thank you so much. Speaking for all secondary pastoral staff and teachers, thank you so much. But not everyone is as on the ball as you are. So we've spent a lot of time talking about, not even, I feel like we haven't even really got past the tip of the iceberg about why this job is draining and just generally horrific. But I do want to kind of focus on in a moment. I do want to focus on some of the bright sides. We can maybe give a little bit of a balanced view for anyone who's considering becoming a head of year, or maybe just doesn't want to end their Monday evening depressed. So we'll try and talk about some positives in a minute.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
So, Jordan. Wow. The lungs trying to make an appearance. Sorry. What would you consider your greatest successes, or the things about this job, about your head of your job, that make you glad that you do it, or that make you feel like it's all worthwhile?
Okay. So we had a student who came in, and she had a really difficult life, really, really difficult. And she came in and I managed to get her finally diagnosed. And she got two diagnoses and managed to get her home life settled right before her exams, which was amazing, because I mean, this kid, we were basically told, she came from another school as a managed move, and we were told basically she's not going to make it. And I remember walking through the playground on the first day, and I just looked at her and I said, listen, we're going to be fine. You just have to work with me. You are going to be absolutely fine. And over the years, yes, she had her moments. Yes, we had the tribulations. We had the trials. We had the...
The trauma.
It was all real. It was all there. But, you know, at the end of it, I am so proud, because she left with 7 GCSEs. She even got A's.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a student that, you know, had basically been written off out of the system. Mm-hmm. You know, she's never going to make it, forget it. And she left with her GCSEs. And I am so proud of her now. I mean, she's doing so fantastic. And the amazing thing is, to this day, she will still say, it was because of you. if you weren't there for me and if you didn't believe in me, I would have never been where I am now. You know, Mother's Day, she still contacts me and she calls me. And she says, I just, happy Mother's Day, my second mum. You know, she really, and she still really, really is so appreciative. And I look back on her and I just think, this is why I do it. This is why I wake up. This is why I do it. Because she's that one kid. She's that one kid that I really made a difference to. And that is, you know, it fills me with overwhelming pride and happiness to see her being able to go out into the world. And, you know, it, she just wasn't expected to be on this path. And she works, she's got a flat, she's, you know, she's doing so well. And I'm so proud of her. So, so proud of her.
Yeah. So, that, yeah, 100%. It's the individual stories. And what you said before about how if you can make a difference to one, what did you say? If you can make a difference to one student, it would be worth it.
One child is worth it. Yeah. If one student leaves, you know, even after school and just thinks there's somebody there that cares, that makes such a massive difference. And that is, you know, that is, that wakes me up in the morning. That gives me, that fills my heart. So, I'm still fighting the fight for all those kids that need somebody. I'm still standing, still standing strong. Yeah, holding them up. Just trying to get them through this system that sometimes they just don't fit in. You know, they just don't fit in that box. They just, they find it really hard. But they're still going and it takes a lot. But if there's anybody out there who feels strong enough, I wouldn't say never do it. And I mean, it's a good experience. It's a good experience.
I mean, a lot of things are good experiences. That doesn't mean you should do them the rest of your life. What is a good experience? Something you learn from, something that tests you, something that pays the bills. Like, define good. At what cost, Jordan?
At what cost? Your mental health.
I feel like it was like, I don't disagree with anything you've said. And if I think about individual kids and because I'm still like you as well, we're still in touch with so many of our students. And it's the best thing. It's the best thing to see how far they've come and for them to turn around and say things like what that student said to you and what some students have said to me. Like I've had a student say like, I would not be here if it weren't for you. Like you literally saved my life. And there's nothing I've done in this job that touches that. And you know that you've made an impact and you can't like, I have no regrets. I have no regrets because I have no regrets.
No.
But.
Absolutely. But. It's
but. But. It is but. It is.
It is.
I think. For me, it just became. It became a matter of weighing the scales, and it's like, okay, I've had this positive impact. I've done this thing, and I have these kids, and that's great. Do I need to continue to do that? Can I step back because the negatives are becoming like the daily.
Yeah.
Just the drip, drip, drip,
daily
drip of,
daily drainage.
of it's like sucking out my soul, the daily frustrations, and being in that position where you're just so vulnerable to idiocy from idiots, and just like the frustration of the job and the misery and the feeling of helplessness you get when you're in a position where you're supposed to be helping these kids, but the system will not allow you to do it. The frustration that comes with that. I was like, this is, I felt like I'd done almost like I've done my bit and I need to now, I need to kind of take some of myself back because you do lose yourself a little bit. I think, like you said,
absolutely, you can do, and it is important that you just try to remember who you are as an individual, who you are outside of work. It can be hard. It is really hard, but it's worthwhile when there is that child or that parent that says thank you. Definitely.
So I mean the question of tonight was, does the reward outweigh the misery? So I'm gonna go first because I like to end on a more positive note. So I'm gonna go first
with you.
Yeah, I think what you said was fair about it. I mean, vague and a bit of a cop out, but it being a good experience. Yeah, okay. I don't regret it.
Okay,
but would it really comes down to would I do this again? I would be ahead of year again if there was a need in the school I was in for someone to fill that role and no one wanted to do it or no one was willing to do it or the people, no, hear me out, or the people that were interested, I thought were just not right. Like if there was a need, like I would step up if there was no one else, because it is such an important position for someone to fill. Like it's, we cannot lose. We are losing support roles left, right, and center. We are down to skeleton staff. These children are not getting adequate support as it is. The worst possible thing would be to not, like for a year group to not have a head of year for a year or a couple of terms. Like I would step in a heartbeat if that was the situation the school was in. Yeah. In a heartbeat. Yeah. Would I do it otherwise? No. No, I would not. Unless... So, like, I don't know what amount of money or what life crisis would change my mind. I really don't. I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back to that place, Jordan. I don't want to go back. Don't make me go back. But if I felt like the kids would suffer if someone didn't step up, and I felt like I was the best person to do that because of my experience, then I would do it. Absolutely. Yeah. Otherwise, nah.
No.
No, it's not worth it. So what do you think? Does the reward outweigh the misery, yes or no?
For me, yes, I think the reward does. You know, surprisingly, I've spoke a lot about a lot of negative things, but I still think that I can make a small difference, and that small difference can be a change in that child's life, ever so slightly. And you can't help them all, but I help those that I can as much as I can. So if I had a choice, I mean, unless somebody was giving me my dream job, which would be, I don't know, traveling the world. Other than that, I actually enjoy it. I just don't like the crap that comes with it, but I would still fight the good fight because we need people. We need good heads of years. We do.
Yeah.
We need good support staff. So,
well, see, that was going to be my cynical follow-up question. You're saying, you know, these kids need someone, but couldn't someone else do it? Don't you want to just save yourself? But I know how good you are. And I don't even want to put that thought into your head that somebody else could just replace you because you are irreplaceable. So,
thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
I hope so.
You have to stay suffering until you retire. Suffering. That's how that's going to go.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, it is after 10 o'clock. So thank you for listening. And thank you, Jordan, for joining me to rant with no plan or solution in mind. Just rant so people know the truth. I appreciate your time. I know, so will I. It always helps. And thank you for listening. And do you know what? If people want to argue with me about this or about how we haven't been fair or, you know, helpful in any way, then find me on Twitter and start an argument. I will die on this hill. It is one of the worst jobs in the school. All right, thank you, Jordan.
Thank you.
Have a good night, and you everyone too. Else have a lovely remainder of your evening.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.